Goddard Reel 3.
I don't remember there being any naval establishment at Hurlingham. Hurlingham was, as I said, established itself as a ballooning place, a place that had the facilities laid on. It had a big connection to the gas main for connecting up the pipes for filling balloons. It had the instructors, or at least the experienced balloonatics, as I might call them, balloonists. It had balloons, or at least the members who owned them kept their balloons there, but they kept them in the wrapped-up, folded-up condition. They didn't keep them inflated, of course. Once you've finished a journey in a balloon, you let all the gas out and just wrap it up and bring it back as a lump of material.
Such civilian facilities for ballooning as there were at Hurlingham, you obviously inherited for your training purposes. Did you also inherit any of the civilian balloonists themselves in perhaps a training capacity?
Oh, yes. Barry Donville was one, who was a great great balloonist, and the other man, whose name I'll remember presently. We only had two instructors who were very experienced men and delightful companions. But, of course, the donkey work of getting the balloons spread out, spreading the nets over them for the inflation of the balloon, then gassing up and connecting them to the mains, and putting on the ballast bags and filling up the ballast bags and doing all that kind of work was done by naval ratings, which were laid on as though, quite invisibly to me. I don't really know where they lived, but I think they already were living at that naval establishment called, which was in fact, the Crystal Palace. The Admiralty took over the Crystal Palace as a centre for naval ratings belonging to both to the Navy and to the Royal Naval Air Service, and I think that these men were transported day by day, probably from the Crystal Palace to Hurlingham. But I'm afraid I never asked.
Before we go on to talking in detail about the various aspects of balloon flying and its relationship to airship flying, could you give me a general idea of how well organised the training at Hurlingham was, how systematic it was?
Well, it was as systematic, I suppose, as the training of the civilian pilots had been. That is to say, you arrived at a pleasant time in the morning and you probably had 11s in the clubhouse, coffee and some biscuits or something like that, and were concerned about the preparation maybe of the luncheon baskets that you were going to take off on your excursion. And by the time that was all collected, and you took yourself over to where the balloons were being inflated, there were already probably three balloons nearly fully inflated with coal gas, and you just had a chat with the instructor about the nets and about them hanging on the ballast bags and that sort of thing. There was no formal instruction at all. To call it a course of training would be rather exalting the process. It was, in fact, just getting experience of what using a balloon amounts to and what the points are about getting the thing ready.
Tell me about the procedures by which you actually gained that experience.
Well, we would stroll over together, talking about this and that, and seeing the balloons, which, of course, was a new experience to us. And let's assume that I hadn't ever been up at all. I was, of course, slightly apprehensive about a new experience, and I was warned, of course, not to smoke in those days when everybody used to smoke cigarettes, not to smoke when we got near the gassing up, and in fact we weren't going to smoke in the air. And then we saw the balloon basket that was going to be hitched on to the nets when the balloon was sufficiently fully inflated to be away from the ground, and lifting up the ballast bags that were successively hung at one mesh lower every minute or two until the balloon itself was clear of the ground, lifting its net and a ring of ballast bags hung on the side. And then the basket, which was quite a weighty affair, would be carried underneath the balloon. And when the balloon got high enough, it would be hitched on to the, I've forgotten the proper names for the bridles that come down from the balloon net, to hitch on with toggles, that is to say, bits of wood which go through a loop on the basket. And There must be about eight of those bridles that come down to the basket, and presently the balloon would be riding in the shelter of the trees. If there was a light wind blowing or not too strong a wind, that would be quite stable. If there was a fairly strong wind, there might be some guys attached to the net to prevent the balloon swaying about too much.
Okay.
And then when everything was ready, and perhaps the pilot himself, that's to say the balloon instructor, might install his own instrument. I don't remember about that. The instruments didn't amount to very much, of course. We had an aneroid, which is really a kind of barometer, which works inversely to tell you how high you are above the ground. That's quite standard practice in aeroplanes now. It depends on the barometric pressure. The other instrument we had was also a pressure instrument, which consisted of a U-tube with a fluid in it, and you could pinch a tube, a rubber tube, connected to one side of this U-tube, which would fix, as it were, the atmospheric pressure at what it was when you put your finger on it. And then if you were ascending or descending in the balloon, the mercury, or not the mercury, the green liquid fluid in this tube would move up or down the other side of the U-tube to show whether the pressure was increasing or decreasing. Of course, if you were descending, the pressure would be relatively increasing, and so the free end of the fluid would go down. And if you were ascending, the converse would happen. And so that was a very simple, I think it was called a stethoscope. That was the name of it, a stethoscope. That would tell you whether you were going up or down. And apart from that, you didn't have any instruments except your watch, which probably wasn't a wristwatch in those days. Could have been just a turnip watch which you had in your waistcoat pocket. Or maybe it was a wristwatch.
Tell me about the various procedures which you had to carry out, the various main procedures you had to carry out when flying a balloon, and the kind of orders which were given and what they meant.
Well, I think that I didn't spend much time telling you about the various parts of the balloon. There is, of course, the balloon itself, which in those days was made of a fabric with a goldbeater skin lining. And those skins were, they grew together if they were taken from a calf's intestine when they were still, as it were, fresh and were put together and laid together underwater. They would grow together and would make an impervious skin to prevent the hydrogen escaping, if hydrogen was going to be used, or similarly with coal gas.
Right.
The balloons, I think, that we were using were already rubberized fabric. And they were covered with a net, which, as I've explained already, supported and held the basket. The basket was festooned with a long trail rope, which was coiled down, which could be 500 or 600 feet long, quite a big, as thick as an ordinary sized man's thumb, and that, when it was thrown onto the ground, would act as more or less as an elastic to lessen the shock of your landing, because as you came lower, more weight was put on the ground, and so more buoyancy was thereby given to the balloon, if you follow me. There was also a grapnel hung on the side, and that had a short length of rope on it, whose name I've forgotten, and it had an eye at one end and a grapnel at the other end. The eye was around the rope that I've just described, and if you wanted to use the grapnel to arrest your drift across the countryside when you were landing, you would slip the grapnel, and that would ride down the rope to the end of the rope, where the ring on the grapnel rope would be held by a knot at the end of the trail rope. When it all was ready, you would all the people who were going to fly would get aboard. Usually there were four or five, I think probably five or six of us young midshipmen and acting sub-lieutenants, and one instructor. And he would come aboard last when we were all on board, with our luncheon baskets and so on. And then the lift would be tested. And That would be done by seeing whether or not the balloon was buoyant when you were on board. Probably it wasn't, because there would be a lot of extra sandbags hung onto the basket to keep it fixed to the ground. Those bags would be taken off until it was quite clear to the captain or the instructor that it was near the point where you were buoyant, and he would then say to those who were holding the balloon, the basket down with their hands, hands off, ease up the guys, that would matter if there were any guys being in use to keep the balloon steady, hands off, ease up the guys. And if the balloon lifted, they're fine, you were buoyant. If it lifted too fast, you were too buoyant. If it didn't lift at all, you would take off some more bags. And then you would be ready to make an easy ascent. He would then say, hold on, and you would hold on. And then when everybody was ready and he was ready, he'd say, let go. And they'd simply take their hands off and let go of the guys on the sides, and you'd drift up into the air, and you'd have, if it was your first experience, of course, you would then have the experience of being airborne and seeing not yourself rising, but the ground sinking away from you. That's one of the things which distinguishes balloon flying from other things. You don't really feel the acceleration of your ascent. You just notice that the ground is receding.
Can we talk now about the kind of skills you learnt during this course of balloon training at Hurlingham, and what the relationship of those skills was to your future job as an airship pilot?
Oh, yes. Yes, that's very important. Of course, an airship is really only an animated or a powered balloon. In fact, they used to be called dirigible balloons, and then they were called dirigibles. But an airship, when its engines stop, is nothing more than a balloon. And so you become then the child of the elements. You conform to whatever is going on in the air. You have no control at all except vertically. You haven't got any control horizontally of your movement, so you have to be taken where the wind chooses to take you. That means that you have to be prepared to make a forced landing as though you were a balloon. And that means you've got to be sensitive to whether you're going up or down, whether you're in ballast, in trim, or whether you're buoyant or not. And that means you have to learn how to vary the use of your gas valve and your ballast. And the essential thing about ballooning is to be sensitive and detect immediately whether you're going up or down, because if you wish to correct a movement, you must do it at once. Otherwise, you gain momentum, you gain speed. If you're falling, you fall faster and faster and faster. And that means to check that descent, you have to overcome the inertia of the balloon and its contents and use much more ballast than you would do if you checked the thing immediately. It's very like life in that respect. The same applies to if you're going up. If you don't detect this and let a little bit of gas go straight away, you may have to let go a lot more gas later on. So that's one thing. Then there's, of course, there's another thing, that is variations in temperature. On a cloudy day of broken clouds, alternately you're under the shadow of a cloud or you're in brilliant sunshine. When you're in brilliant sunshine, you heat up and the gas expands and you become much more buoyant. And consequently, if you're going to be in the sunshine for a long time, you'll either ascend a good deal or else you'll check that ascent by letting go some gas. Similarly, if you go under a cloud, and you're going to be under a cloud for a long time, you'll cool down, and that means you're going to descend, and you may have to let go of ballast to keep your height. But if it's only intermediate, it's only as an interval of time, quite brief, then you perhaps disregard it, and save your ballast, and save your gas.
Now, this skills you've been describing, could you illustrate for me the way in which they also had an application in flying airships? For example, this question of inertia, which you've described with the balloon.
Well, yes, I was describing, of course, what happens to an airship when the engines have stopped. And although I seem to be talking about balloons, I was talking about an airship that had become a balloon because its engine power had failed. But when the engine power is going, then you do have control of considerable control, but nevertheless the principles still apply that when the sun is shining on that ship which is sailing through the air under its own power, it is getting more and more buoyant, and it can either correct that additional buoyancy by flying with its nose down a bit so as to get a negative pressure on the top of the balloon, like an aerofoil, and cause it not to rise despite the fact that it's more buoyant, or alternatively, it can let go gas. Well, now, that principle, which you've learnt in ballooning and had rammed into you by experiencing the effects of heating and cooling, stay with you when you're flying an airship, and you do therefore realize and remember that you are, all the time you're in the sunshine, and as the sun is getting hotter, you're getting more buoyant, and as the sun cools down or lowers in the evening, you are necessarily getting heavier. And this is a dynamic principle you have to correct, and you have to similarly watch it as regards inertia, just like you did before.
Could you compare the use of gas and ballast on a balloon with its use on an airship?
Well, in a balloon you carry sand ballast, because when you drop sand ballast it spreads out in the air and it doesn't cause anybody any harm, and you don't have watertight tanks to carry it. It's quite easy to have a series of sandbags. But in an airship, it's inconvenient to have sand because you'll stay up for a good long time and the sand can get frozen together and then would not release automatically. So you carry water with an antifreeze substance in it, and you release water instead of releasing sand. That's one distinction in an airship, but the principle is the same.